This episode of This Week on Broadway is sponsored by SeatGeek. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, add a promo code, and enter the promo code BR20. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk with Michael John Lacusa. We review Huey, Disaster, Straight, Eclipse, The Somewhere Project's production of West Side Story, Boy at the Clermont Theater, Walk Hard at the Metropolitan Playhouse, That Physics Show at the Electra Theater, and National Tour of Kinky Boots. This time we really get it in. All that plus more. Please stay tuned.
In a house that will never be a home. Do you know what I want most when my daughter is gone to sleep?
When the pundits on the TV shows have locked my hair and hats and clothes.
When the gossip monger cease to buzz over ancient news that never was.
When I've been debriefed, detoxed, deplayed.
When I've tallied weight that's lost or gained.
Do you know what I want?
Do you know what I want?
In a house that will never be a home.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, March 7, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Matt Tamanini. Matt is Broadway World's senior TV and film critic and the host of Some Like It Pop podcast, which is available on iTunes and Stitcher. You can connect with Matt on Twitter at BWWMatt. Good evening, Matt.
Hey, James, how are you?
I'm good, and you?
Doing great.
Good. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good evening, Michael.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Good evening.
So our listeners, we have had a crazy, inconsistent schedule, and that's all my fault. We had some audio problems last week, and in last week's show, we announced that Matt was reviewing Kinky Boots, and we had some other reviews in there that you didn't hear in last week's show. That was because of audio problems. We brought back Matt this week to do the Kinky Boots review. Yay, Matt.
Yay.
With us today, we have a very special guest. Michael John Lacusa is with us. Michael is a five-time Tony Award-nominated composer, lyricist, librettist for his Broadway productions of The Wild Party, Marie Christine, and The Chronicle of a Death Foretold. Michael John, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule. We're going to get into your schedule right now because you're calling us from Old Globe out in San Diego, aren't you?
That's right. I'm out here in San Diego working on a new show called Rain, directed by Barry Edelstein, and that I collaborated along with my librettist, Sybil Pearson, and we're in rehearsals for that right now.
Sybil from Giant.
Yes, Sybil Pearson from Giant, who wrote the book for Giant, that indeed. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you keep the good ones with you, don't you?
I try to. Well, if they're good, you don't let them go. You hold them close and treat them well if you can. So.
You know, and although it does feel sort of like springtime here in New York, you got out to San Diego in February. How long have you been out there?
I feel very badly about that. I feel terrible. It's such terrible weather out here. Oh, my God, I can't stand it. It's just horrible. That's what I've been telling all my friends back in New York, at least. Sending many pictures.
Do you have an intern that fans you at rehearsal?
Pardon me, repeat?
Do you have an intern that will fan you at rehearsal to keep hot air off you?
Well, we're very well air-conditioned here in the basement of the Old Globe Theater rehearsal halls here, so I don't get a lot of sun, you know, just only in the morning hours and a little bit after 5:30 when there's what little love is left at 5:30. So it's not like I'm tanning and relaxing by the pool, guys.
It's not hard. Half a glass of white wine at sunset or something like that?
Vodka. Well-earned vodka.
Tell us about Rain. Rain is an adaptation of a movie, isn't it?
Well, it's an adaptation of Somerset Maugham's short story, Rain, published back in the early 20s, and it's been adapted into dramatic form. It's a very famous play made of it many, many years ago, as well as three or four movie adaptations that starred many different actresses like Gloria Swanson or Joan Crawford, as well as
Rita Hayworth,
I believe,
right?
Did one. Yep, yeah. As well. And there was even a musical version of it done once that Peter Felicia had mentioned, I think, last time I spoke when he knew that I was going to be doing Rain, and he mentioned the June Havoc version of it all, which I've heard lovely songs from. I don't think it lasted very long on the Great White Way, but there was also a musical version of it all, too, at some point a long time ago. But this is all new and all rocking and rolling here, and we're having a great time working. Wonderful cast, too. I'm very excited to be working with Eden Espinosa for the very first time. She's truly, truly remarkable, and I've always wanted to work with her, and she's really quite incredible, and I'm enjoying every single minute of it. And it is the artistic director, Barry Edelstein's first musical that he's directing, and he's well known for his Shakespeare work, and it's been so thrilling to work with him, and this thing that he's bringing to the piece is very, very exciting. The ability to look at music as drama, it's really remarkable, and we're having a great time working on it.
You know, back to Sybil Pearson, you may find this funny, and I may have told you this once before, Michael John, but of course she wrote Baby. She wrote the book to Baby.
Indeed she did.
And, you know,
and
which
Tony
was
nominated for that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, which was quite some time ago, but then I believe that that was really her only musical theater credit for a while, and for some reason, a bunch of us people thought that she was not a real person.
we just thought
that she was like, you know, like sometimes
a
it's
made
a
up name, right?
yeah and maybe it was actually
wrote
it, but I guess you can confirm that she's a real person.
She is definitely a real person. I have the scars to show for it, and she's really quite no she's indeed very, very real and quite extraordinary writer too. And so she really stopped writing after Baby musicals, and she continued to write plays, of course, but
right.
And she can tell you this herself if you ever talk to her. She has a great, fascinating story of how she how I literally have been teaching with her for a number of years working at NYU, and when it came time to when I had the opportunity to do Giant, I turned to her. I did not want to do Giant alone. Sometimes I do write shows on my own. I do book music and lyrics, like with First Daughter Suite, and I thought, well, okay, I can't do Giant alone since it's going to be 5.5 hours and 3 days of plays. And I said, I won't do that alone. So that's when I turned to Sybil at NYU and I said, would you like to join me? And the same thing I did when we were working on Giant in New York when it was about to premiere. I said, okay, girl, we got to get back on the saddle and find something new. And I said, read Rain, which is another impossible and very challenging story to do. And she took the bait and ran with it. So now we're back in the saddle, like I say.
So Rain, the underlying property, you have to narrow it down and make judicious cuts to tell the story. How is that for you? Take some out, add some?
Well, interestingly enough, because we are basing it on the short story, not the movie or mm-hmm. the player. We're basing it on Somerset Maugham's short story. And as with any short story, it's relatively short on plot and short on character, it's very, very, very compact. So very often, when you do adapt short story, and I've done that several times, like say with the Debbie Eisenberg short stories, which became Little Fish, or the Ryona Kutagawa stories, Ryona Sugiya Kutagawa short stories that turned into See What I Want to See. Mm. Short stories are notorious in the fact that you may have to invent things to expand the story and make it into theater. Oftentimes, in a short story, a lot of the great incidences actually don't even occur on the page; they're inferred to. And in theater, you want to, you have to have the drama on stage. You have to put the action on stage. And so a lot of invention is necessary for it all to expand sometimes and also keep the idea of compression and tightness. So there's two things that operate when you adapt short story. It's one of the most difficult forms of literature to turn into theater, much less music theater as well. And, of course, you must create characters that want to sing. And that's what we hopefully have done here.
So as far as the expansion, there is a very, very different situation than you faced with Giant.
Very different, much different. Well, this is the whole thing. It's like when we were talking about what we'd like to do next, and we both looked at each other and said, "Not Giant, something small and one act, and with like five or six characters, please." And that's what made me turn to my bookshelf of the to-do list. You know, I have a bookshelf that has all these little titles of books that stare at me every morning when I wake up and kind of go, "Are you going to musicalize me?" This one story, Rain, I'd wanted to do for a number of years. It had been suggested about 10 years ago to me to turn into a musical. And I said, well, that's the project that we should do. We know that's compact, short, won't go on for 3.5 hours, won't require, 25 people, and will not require an orchestra of like 5 million. So, and cows, no cows in this one. So it's really quite thrilling to go from the giant-sized giant to this more compact and condensed version of a really remarkable and iconic short story. The story of Sadie Thompson is just something that's been around for years, and it always is something that people keep coming back to, and it's very fascinating.
Yeah.
You have performances beginning on March 24th with an opening night on April 1st.
March 24th is when we begin our previews, yes, and we open on, April Fool's Day, which is the same day that my First Lady Suite CD is being released.
Oh, great.
So it's like, I don't know, I should look at my horoscope or something like that. I'm wondering, why does everything converge on April the 1st at April Fool's Day. Why?
Well, you have to buy a Powerball ticket or something for that day, just in case.
Maybe so. I think it's a good idea, actually. Might just do that, yeah.
So you are, as we record this, it's February 29th, so you have just about 1 month until you're hitting opening night. And
right.
How long have you been out there working on this?
Well, we're in now our second week of rehearsals right now, and we're in the process of blocking and getting this thing on its feet now. And we've got a beautiful set, and it's a rather complicated thing because we see all our characters at all times on stage. So it's very much like I told Barry Edelstein, our director, I said it's much like the Vulcan chessboard in Star Trek, how we configure people in the room, because people's behavior also feeds into whatever song may or may not be happening at that time on stage. So it's a very, very fascinating, very complex staging that has to go on with the piece, and we're having a great time discovering it and learning as we go along what we need and what we don't need.
Did you workshop this or do readings of it in New York or...?
Yes, we did. We did a short reading of it, a week's reading of it in New York about 2 years ago, I think it was. Well, no, about a year and a half ago. And then we did it at Vassar at New York Stage and Film this past summer in July. And we did a two-week workshop of that at the New York Stage and Film. That was simply a stage reading, if you want. And it wasn't even stage. It was just mostly music stand readings and stuff. So.
It's an amazing cast that you got. You mentioned Eden Espinosa, but you also have Betsy Morgan, Rusty Ross, Mike Sears, Tally Sessions, Jared Zarelli,
Elizabeth Davis. We just posted all our pictures on the website. They're beautiful, a couple gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous ones of the cast and of Eden and Jared Zarelli, who's playing the minister, Alfred. Beautiful pictures. You can find them on www.theoldglobe.org, I think it is, .org.
Yeah.
And you can find them there. And also, too, I think we've got some press releases on Broadway World, et cetera, and you can get a glimpse of what Eden looks like in the tropics. Oh, my God.
Well, you always get great people. You really do. And First Daughter Suite is another... amazing example.
I'm so lucky. I know. I'm very lucky and very humbled that the ladies and the men want to come play and work on really, really challenging stuff. I mean, I always kind of have to apologize and go, I'm so sorry. I'm not doing something simpler here. But it's just, and they go, no. We love the challenge. We really love it. It's something that we long for. And so I feel a little gratified that, the folks who, who stay very loyal to me that I've worked with over the years have always, when I've said I got a new part coming up, and they'll go, yes. immediately. It's just always such an honor, and I feel very blessed by that.
So tell us about the First Order Suite. We have the cast recording that's going to be coming out April 1st, and it just played down at the Public. You've got all the pistons firing here.
I know I've got all the women firing away. I mean, that is a formidable group of ladies that I was lucky enough to have assembled, and with my director Kirsten Sanderson, we put together a great team: designers and music directors and orchestrators, it is about those ladies, and a lot of them I've worked with before and have written for Teresa McCarthy and Mary Testa and of course Betsy Morgan, and I was so lucky to be able to work for the first time with wonderful Casey Levy and with Rachel Bay Jones, whom, you know, these women are just, and they poured their hearts and their souls into the piece. Our little Amy Carter there, Carly Tamer, was just a joy and a half to work with, and just such a pleasure. And of course, Allison Fraser, one of my oldest friends, and
yes,
go back forever, and we've never been able to, you know, collide and work together, because she's always been busy and I've always been busy, and it's just been crazy, but we had a great chance to, you know, just have fun and juicy stuff go on in the room. It's just delightful, absolutely delightful.
You may have been asked this before, and you may have answered it, so I apologize in advance. But several people commented that the First Daughter Suite was as much about the first ladies as about the first daughters, or significantly about the first ladies. Anyway, so I was wondering, was any of it already in the works, any of the material for the First Lady Suite?
Oh, no.
Really?
None of it was in the works. No, absolutely not. It was a very unusual thing. In fact, I approached the idea with great trepidation, because I don't like to revisit, you know, territory I've already done. You know, I've tried to avoid that.
Right.
The thing about why, but it is the first daughters, because every one of the first ladies is a daughter. And,
right, right.
You know what I mean? Is a daughter, and that's one of the fundamental points of the piece, is that that's something that's inescapable in your relationships with other women. I mean, and it's one of the reasons why I chose to write the piece, because I just found such a void in theater in general, not just musicals, but theater in general, about women and their relationships with their mothers. Mm. And what makes them mothers and what makes them daughters, or, you know, and that even goes as far as mother-in-laws and daughters-in-laws. So that's included in this story. There's always these relationships of who's a mother and who's a daughter.
Right.
The piece Mary Testa plays Barbara Bush, and yes, it's about Barbara Bush's experience, but it's just as much Laura Bush's experience as well.
Right.
And then many times when you ask a woman, what is your relationship like with your mother? I always think it's great. I tell my guys, I say, if you really want a good pickup line, ask a woman what's the relationship with her mother, you know, and that'll just you'll hear, you know, an absolute American Horror Story, you know, or you'll hear a Disney movie or something in between, you know, but it always gets a woman to open up when you ask that question. You know, it's a very fascinating question, and I've heard so many stories, and I don't find that very often represented on the stage, so it was a real challenge and something that I really wanted to do, and that's what made me prompt myself to actually go back to the first ladies. You know, when I wanted to write something about mothers and daughters,
right, right,
I went, wait a minute, you know, and that is true. I felt there was something more to say, you know, but I didn't want to retread. I didn't want to write a sequel, and I didn't want to do any of that. I really wanted to have a new thematic idea behind these pieces. But then it was kind of fun, though, that it turned into an interesting little companion piece to it all, which I didn't expect to, which was very fun to work on.
Well, I don't know if you're aware of it, but there's a new musical in the works called The First Gentleman. And it's
good.
About the first, you know, anticipating a possible Hillary Clinton situation. You know, it's about the first, well, it's just what it sounds like. So I guess maybe that'll be the next wave.
Is it First Gentleman, or what would it be? Yeah, I don't know. Is that the title that they would settle on? See, it's very interesting, the nomenclature that they're going to have to settle on when Hillary wins the election, because I think that it would be president and president, wouldn't it?
Well, in that case,
he's already. Yeah, but yes, I mean, this the whoever are writing this are just, I guess they're assuming it will be the first gentleman, because what else would it be? The first husband.
Oh, it's too bad. I always like the word consort.
Yes.
I said it was sexy. There was something sexy about consort.
Well,
too bad we're not British anymore.
Sarah Palin won, she'd be the first dude.
Oh, yeah, she said that, didn't she? Given the state of affairs, I wouldn't doubt that somehow or another she might wind up in there someday.
So tell us about the recording process for First Order Suite.
Well, it was absolutely wonderful. You know, it was great because if I can, and we have the budget and we have the scheduling to allow for it all, I love when you can get in immediately after opening to record a show. I just feel it's fresher. I think it's more vital. I think it's as close to what we opened with. And there's just an energy that I find that's different than when one does an album, you know, say months after the fact, or, you know, when the roles have been worn into, you know what I mean? And so I felt very strongly that if we could, it would be great to get First Daughter Suite in there immediately, as soon as we open, and we were very fortunate to do that. So I feel when I've listened to the mixes and finally the final cut and the final release that we have here, I feel it's really, really almost very live. It feels like it's actually a radio play of sorts because there's such a liveness to it all. These people are still learning the roles in a lot of respects because of the short amount of rehearsal time that there is in the piece that we had for the piece. And so I feel that there's an energy in there that I really, really, really like and I'm very happy with.
No, I'm
and
sorry.
That's true with the orchestra too, as well.
I haven't noticed. Is it one or two CDs?
Two CDs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great! Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, there's so much that we went, oh my gosh, if we cut this, what's this going to do? And of course, the Patty by the Pool piece, which is about Nancy Reagan and her daughter Patty Davis, it's almost all dialogue.
Right.
And with these interjections and crazy interjections, and I said, "Oh my gosh, too! How do we do this?" And fortunately, everybody was brave enough to say, "You know what? We're going to do the whole thing," and raise the money to do it. And it was just really, really terrific to be able to put virtually every single beat on the album, and it really is. It's a really great listening experience for any of you. If you haven't seen the show, you really will get a sense of what the show's about, which is really terrific.
Fantastic.
So, First Order Suite, has there been any talk about regional and licensed productions?
Yeah, Rodgers and Hammerstein will be licensing the piece, which is just wonderful. They've got several of my works there, so I'm very, very excited by that. And I have lots of inquiries already about it, which is just terrific. Some people want to put both First Lady Suite and First Daughter Suite together, which would be, I think, a fabulous thing. Epic. You know, another 5-hour evening, which I'm not sure I'm up for after Giant, but it was it's definitely something worth thinking about and considering.
It could be an Angels in America afternoon evening type of thing.
It could very well be. Absolutely, I love that idea. I love it. Absolutely. Not right now. I've got my little reign to finish up and do, and talk to me next year.
Absolutely. So Rain is running March 24th to May 1st at the
May 1st is our closing date, yes.
Yeah, at the Old Globe Theater out San Diego. Mm-hmm. So everybody jump on a plane and go out and see it.
Oh, yeah, come on. It's nice out here.
And after the show, Michael John will take you out for vodka.
Vodka. Tita's vodka on the rocks.
Michael John, thank you so much for joining us on your, in between your rehearsals and time off and things like that, to come on and talk with us on Broadway Radio.
James and Michael, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and say hello to Peter for me. I hope that he is well. And and thanks very much for having me on board, guys. Take good care of yourself. Stay warm. I know it's not spring yet. You know how tricky it can be out there.
All right.
Sending you some sunshine. Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
This week's episode is sponsored by SeatGeek. SeatGeek has taken all the work and hassle out of shopping for tickets. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated and try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They've made it easier than ever to buy and sell tickets for theater, sports, and music. SeatGeek pulls all the tickets available on all the sites in one place so you can save time and you never miss a deal. Best of all, SeatGeek is honest and upfront about the price. Unlike other ticket sites, SeatGeek shows you the full ticket price from start to finish and never surprises you with huge fees at checkout. Broadway Radio listeners can get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the Settings tab and click Add a Promo Code. Enter our code, which is BR20. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. If you are a fan of Broadway Radio, I hope that you will support SeatGeek. Download the app and give it a try. Okay, so the three of us, Michael, Peter, and I, got a chance to see Huey on Broadway. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with Huey?
Well, it's very interesting that this is the fourth production of Huey to reach Broadway in 51 years. It's pretty surprising considering it's such a short play, but it hasn't always been done independently of any other play. This time it is, and as you may have already heard, it's closing at the end of the month, and people are saying, well, you know, people don't want to see Eugene O'Neill. Well, you know, the thing is, Forest Whitaker isn't that big a star. Has it occurred to anybody that there is an audience out there that feels they're not going to pay Broadway prices for an hour? I think that's really one of the big problems why it's not selling. The word has got out that you will be out in no time at all. And whatever else, the value or the virtues or the liabilities of the show, I think that's first and foremost what's bothering a lot of people. Anyway, this is about a guy who shows up in a hotel, very disappointed that he doesn't have Huey to talk to anymore because Huey has died, which he knows because he went to the hospital to see him when he was sick and he went to his funeral. Now, most guests don't do this for desk clerks in hotels. Take it from one who was a desk clerk all through his college years. But what this man is somebody who's terribly lonely. And as a result, he has to connect with somebody, and the desk clerk of the hotel is the one with whom he connects. I felt bad for the desk clerk having to listen to him go on and on and on, just as I used to have to do with John C. Underwood, who would never leave the desk when he was in the hotel. I mean, he drove all of us crazy. Anyway, I have great sympathy for the desk clerk, played by Frank Wood. Is this the first time, by the way, that a Broadway production has had both stars with the same initials? I'm just wondering. You know, I have no idea if that's true or if it happens all the time, but I've never noticed it before. So, anyway, here's Erie Smith, the Forest Whitaker character, who's single, and he notes that Huey was a family man, you know, a wife, two kids, had probably the night clerk job, you know, like from 11 at night till 7 in the morning was the second job. So no wonder the guy died young. I mean, he just had a hard time of it. So what we really see here is pretty much the same thing that George Firth and Stephen Sondheim had to say when they wrote Company, which was that being married still beats being alone. You may agree with that, you may not, but nevertheless, that seems to be what's going on here, that we feel bad for Erie Smith because he's all alone, and he has to rely on conversations like this with people, and who knows if the Frank Wood character is going to give him much attention. At times he does, at times he doesn't, at times he has to admit he doesn't know what he's saying, he's not paying attention, etc. But Forest Whitaker, I think, is very, very good and acquits himself nicely. And for all the talk about how he didn't know his lines, you couldn't tell it from the night I was there. He seemed perfectly fine and able. And all this stuff about going to the water cooler to get cues, I didn't see any of it. So it is a worthwhile endeavor, but boy, would it have killed them to put on a second play and make it 2 one-act plays? I'll grant you double bills don't do well anymore, but I bet a double bill would have done better than just an hour-long show of Huey.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Wow, I didn't see that coming. That review of Forrest Whitaker, I thought he was completely inadequate for the task of this play. I thought he was extremely bad. You know what I noticed? There was no moment when he was obviously struggling with his lines that I noticed, but the way it manifested itself to me is there were these infinitesimal pauses in every line, between certain words of every line, and it started to drive me crazy in like his second or third speech. I thought there were some diction problems too, but I just think he didn't – I thought he was not charismatic at all. I didn't think he had any inner life for the character. I thought he was – really, really inadequate. I have to say, I'm very surprised to hear Peter say otherwise. I thought it started out really well because the set by Christopher Oram is absolutely gorgeous. He also did the costumes, by the way.
The set was magnificent. Yes, indeed. I should have mentioned it. Good for you, Michael. Go on.
Yeah, no, definitely. The curtain goes up on that set, and I was like, oh. And then also Frank Wood, at the very beginning, it's only Frank Wood standing there behind the desk. And Frank Wood is one of those actors, a Tony Award winner, by the way, who to me has a tremendous amount of magnetism even when he's just standing there and not saying anything. So the first impression was really strong, and then Forrest Whitaker came in through the revolving doors upstage, and he got entrance applause, and his first few lines seemed to go really well in the way he was addressing the night clerk. But then, to me, his performance just fell apart, and I on the one hand, yes, it's a bit cheeky to ask – anyone to pay Broadway prices for an hour show, but on the other hand, for me, thank God it was it was only like 65 minutes or whatever it was, because I could not wait to get out of there, and that's my review.
by the way, in case people are wondering, gee, is this the shortest, smallest role that a previous Tony winner has ever had? Because Frank Wood has very, very few lines, comparatively speaking. The answer is a decisive no, because way back in the 80s, Charles Nelson Reilly appeared in a play called Charlotte with Uta Hagen, where he had no lines at all, Not a one. And I remember asking him, why did you do this play where you had no lines? He said, because my respect for Uta Hagen was so great, I wanted to see her in action. And even sitting in the front row wasn't close enough for me. This way I could be on stage with her and watch her acting processes, and that was enough value for me. So it didn't take that much of his life anyway. The show closed in a week. I mean, it had about a less than a month worth of performances. But still, he will probably forever hold the record as the shortest role for a Tony winner, because he went for How to Succeed way back in 1962.
So, I did not see Pacino. Did you, Peter?
Yeah. And I thought Forrest Whitaker was substantially better. But this is a very controversial performance. There have been great reviews for him and bad reviews for him. So we're really representing here.
That's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Times review was a completely positive, a single negative word in it.
Yeah, but that's people I've talked to, love to hate. So this is a very good cross-section that we're doing here. We're representing both ends of the spectrum, and I think that's pretty good.
Well, I'm coming down on the Portantier side. I hated it. And I was embarrassed for him.
We shan't be speaking anymore, Mr.
After we finish recording tonight, I shall not speak to you until tomorrow. I guarantee that.
It's a deal.
All right. So, yeah, I was all I could think of was, wow, Vanity Project, why did they do this?
And yet four productions in 51 years.
Yeah.
Really, that's amazing that they keep trotting this one out. I mean, that's a lot every 11 years or so to see.
Well,
this.
So who else did it? Pacino did it?
Jason Robards
was the one who first did it on Broadway back in 1964.
But, I mean, these are Pacino, Jason Robards, tour de force.
Yeah. Bengazzara in the 70s, he did it too. So that's,
and I believe I just read, not on Broadway, but didn't Brian Dennehy do it somewhere?
Yeah. Brian Dennehy did it in Long Wharf, I know, and I think somewhere else. So, yeah, it attracts actors, I mean, it is a good showcase. The first time I ever saw it was in a college production at MIT, of all places, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So I guess if you got an actor who really wants to show off and another actor who doesn't, you're going to get productions of Huey.
All right. So let's move beyond Huey. We've talked about it longer than the actual show.
Well, we should mention that in case you haven't heard, it's closing 2 months early of what was originally announced to be the end of its limited engagement. So so regardless of how anyone feels, it's not selling.
Yeah. So again, if you are listening to this broadcast and this is something that interests you, you better get down there quick. Don't wait, or else it might be a disaster.
Oh,
segue.
So, Peter, you got a chance to see some musical called Disaster, which Michael played up for us a few months ago in its off-Broadway incarnation. What did you think about it?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the fact that you always hear how actors should not act with children or animals. There's Seth Rudetsky on stage. He doesn't have to worry about the animals because they're only stuffed animals. Children, well, there's a child, but he plays children. I know that sounds odd, but actually they have one child actor, a kid who's terrific beyond belief, with the name of Bailey Luttrell. Bailey is spelled B-A-Y-L-E-E. However, it's a boy. Anyway, because it seems like feminine spelling to me, but anyway.
His father is a Backstreet Boy, by the way.
So I've been told that.
All these pop stars like to name their kids a little differently, Blue Ivy and Apple. So an odd spelling of Bailey is actually better than what it could have been.
Yes, I mean, like, it could have been aspartame or something like that. But anyway, the kid's terrific playing fraternal twins, a girl and a boy. And so he has to jump behind scenery a lot and put on a baseball cap that has a girl's wig in it and then zip back in and take it off. All right, that's not the real problem. It's not so much that, but Seth Rudetsky does not have nearly as much stage dust on his feet as do the people who have a total of 12 Tony nominations that are on that stage. We're talking about Roger Bouts. We're talking about Faith Prince. We're talking about even Manuel Felciano, who was in Sweeney Todd. He got a nomination. He's a glorified chorus boy in this show. But you add them up with Cary Butler and Adam Pascal, and you put them all together, and Kevin Chamberlain, and you get 12 Tony nominations and 2 wins for Roger Bart and for Faith Prince. And don't be surprised, by the way, if there isn't a 13th nomination by the time all this comes to an end, because Jennifer Simard, who got a Dramatist nomination 2 years ago, and deservedly so, it depends how long it runs and all that, but still, she really should, if there's any justice in the world, and we know there's not, would get a Tony nomination and maybe even a win. You know, it's not impossible because she's really terrific playing a singing nun who has a gambling addiction and is fighting it all the way. And there's a lot of religious repression going on. But anyway, so Seth looks a little uncomfortable up there. It looks a little amateurish. He's doing his best. It's not an embarrassing performance by any stretch of any imagination. But he just is outclassed, you know. And, you know, this is a real conundrum when you're writing a show and you want the best possible people in it, and yet you want to be in it too, that you've written a part for yourself, you know. So when it was done off Broadway, there were wonderful people in it too, but not of this caliber for the most part. There were very few holdovers, and under those circumstances, Seth does come off of looking a little less good than he might. However, he's done a reasonably good job with Jack Plotnick and a guy named Drew Jurassic, who seems to have been circling around this project as well in one way or another, that they've written a parody of those movies that used to be in the multiplexes in the 70s, and fitting that, they decided to take songs from the 70s and stick them in here and there. I have to say I respect these three guys so much for having listened to virtually every song that was done in the 70s and torturously listening to every syllable where they could pull out something that would fit something they're doing. And especially in that famous middle brow standard Feelings, there's a very good joke that they get in wasn't originally in the song, believe me, but they're not changing any lyrics here. Most of the songs don't last very long. This is going to be a very odd original cast album if it's made, and I guarantee you if it's made, there's going to be a lot of dialogue on it because they have to set up what the songs are doing. Unfortunately, so much of the time, a vamp will come in, and if you know the song, then you got the joke already. That happens very early in the show. with the song from Mahogany. So you know what they're going to be saying. They're much better off when they just simply start without any vamps at all. And that happens more often than not. But really, much of the time, they only do an A section or a couple of A sections. And that's the end of it because the joke's over. And they know it. And that's to their credit that they're not having us hear the whole song. So anyway, so Seth is a professor who predicts there's going to be an earthquake. And of course, this new floating casino that Roger Bart has built and spent a lot of money on is going to be impacted by this earthquake, though of course he's in denial about it. And there's a love interest too, because a Times reporter comes to cover the opening, and she meets her old boyfriend whom she left at the altar, and he got so discouraged he's become a waiter, even though he really had goals to be a great inventor of games and toys and things like that. But all that's gone. Faith Prince plays the Shelley Winters type character, who's in a woman of a certain age, and her husband, Kevin Chamberlain, they're very much in love, but of course their love is going to be impacted by something that happens to Faith Prince. It doesn't happen early enough in the show. It doesn't happen until the second act, which I know a lot of people have not seen. People I've talked to have gone to Disaster. So if you've gone to Disaster and you left it intermission, let me point out that Faith Prince's character really gets going in the second act, and she has a lot to do as a result of something that she says in the second act and reveals about herself that she could have just as easily done in the first act. Most of the time, it's reasonably witty, but like any spoof, it's too long. It's in two acts, as I mentioned, and one of the reasons it's in two acts because you need to put on a great deal of makeup and distressed clothes during intermission when the earthquake does come. I'm sure that's not a spoiler. Anyway, So the only point where it really gets embarrassing is where somebody gets stuck in gets an arrow shot in his stomach and he's dying, and then the music starts and suddenly he bolts right up and he starts singing as if nothing's wrong with him at all. It's a very cheap laugh. You've seen it a million times. And given the fact that the show lasts much too long, that could have really gone and nobody would have missed it. So anyway, I don't know what's going to happen to Disaster. I wouldn't be surprised if it closes the first weekend it can. I wouldn't be surprised if it got a nomination for Best Book of a Musical, and I mean that. Where she stops, nobody knows. This is a very unpredictable thing. I think a lot of people would have predicted when it was at St. Luke's, and not doing that great business, that it would have ever made it to Broadway. And this is a real testament to Seth Rudetsky's tenacity, his talent as a writer, and his popularity as a talk show host on Sirius Radio and doing these benefits and doing the Playbill cruises and all that. I've heard him referred to as the mayor of Broadway. And all those connections have certainly helped to get him to the Nederlander Theater. We'll see if, of course, the public is going to keep him there.
All right. So Disaster, get out and see it. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Next.
And by the way, we had Seth and Jack on the podcast when the show was playing off Broadway. So that's something we might want to dig up.
Oh, yeah. So I'll put links to the Seth's been on twice. the morning that we interviewed him, they had not signed the contract yet for the Broadway production of Disaster, and he kept on alluding, saying,
right,
he kept on saying, yeah, there's big news, I can't tell you. It's big news, I can't tell you. I'm like, okay. So I thought Streisand was going to pop out of our Skype call here, you know, but it never happened. So anyway, next up we have Straight, which Michael and Peter got a chance to see. So Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Yes, I really enjoyed it very much. It was so interesting to me because, unfortunately, I can't really talk about it. Something happens at the very end of the play that literally made, I would say, at least half the audience gasp out loud. And I, to this day, I have not been able to decide if it was great playwriting or a really dirty trick on the audience. So, but the fact that that it had that effect on people and that I'm still thinking about it and that I haven't made that decision, I think that in itself maybe, tilts it towards the really good playwriting side. This is a play by two authors, which is rather unusual, isn't it? Especially nowadays. Scott Elmgreen and Drew Fornarola. And it's at the Acorn at Theater Row. And it's only three characters, Jake Epstein, Jenna Gavigan, and Thomas E. Sullivan. And it's about the central character, I would say, is Ben, played by Jake Epstein. And he is... I guess we are supposed to think, and he says that he is bisexual, but he is now conducting this torrid affair with this fellow who he's met, Chris, played by Thomas E. Sullivan, even though he already has Ben does already have a girlfriend, Emily Jenna Gavigan. And it's really about that, and if he's going to decide to label himself as gay or straight, or if he's going to try to continue this as long as he can to have this relationship with both people, or if he's going to choose between them. And that's what the play is about, directed by Andy Sandberg, by the way. And I really enjoyed it, but I should probably see it again because I just don't know. And also, how can I say this? It seems like the ending also, it seems like it's very abrupt in a way. And it also seems like one of the characters does not have an ending. But again, I don't know if that's a liability or a really bold step by the playwrights. So I wish I could be more specific. I really, really can't. I would say it's definitely worth seeing.
All right, Peter, what was your reaction?
I had a million problems with this play. First off, fewer with the play than with the production, actually. So much of this play is directed as a comedy, and I hold Andy Sandberg to task for that because I don't think this is a subject for comedy, frankly, and that is the fact that a man here is cheating on his girlfriend, who he's led to believe he's going to marry, even though it's been a very long courtship, not as long as Adelaide and Nathan, but a long time, and he's essentially stringing her along while he's at the very least experimenting, and that's really quite a euphemism, because if you watch this play for any length of time, he is definitely tilting towards the gay side. So I feel bad about that. Another thing that's a problem for me in terms of the production is the casting of the young woman playing the love interest, because she's supposed to be this very, very accomplished, brainy woman. Now, I will admit that brainy people come in all shapes and sizes and types. And maybe I am looking at this too conventionally. And maybe Andy Sandberg said, no, I'm going to do a bold stroke here. I'm not going to give you somebody who really seems like this sophisticated, full of gravitas type of woman. I'm going to give you a pretty, perky, bubble-heady type of actress to play this role. And I feel that this is a strange type of sabotaging to make us think less of the woman, that the authors really had somebody far more intellectual and accomplished in mind than this actress seems to be able to play. So I say she's miscast. Again, if indeed Sandberg were to say to me, no, that's what I was going for, why should it always be a certain type that is considered brainy? I'll concede the point immediately. What I will not concede, and this is the play's problem, she walks in on them.
I know. I knew you were gonna. I forgot to mention that. Please go on.
She walks in on them. She walks in on them, and you know, of course, in real life they would have been naked, but you know, theater, movie, plays, all those things. They're wearing underwear. And yet, you know, there they are in their underwear, and the excuse that's given is, oh, isn't that great, guys sitting around their underwear watching the football game. I guess that does happen. However, I'm amazed that this would be her first impulse, assuming that's what's going on. And she doesn't give it a thought. And, you know, again, if she's supposed to be this really intellectual woman, I think she would be able to put two and two together on an issue like this. I know many of us have blind spots and we get naive in certain places. Sure, sure. But the thing is, she has time to think about this. The play takes place over several weeks. And the next time she saw him, I would expect her to say, you know, I've been thinking about walking in on you guys. And is it possible that the reason we're not getting married, that you're stalling, that you don't want to live with me? Could it be that? You know, and that doesn't come up at all. All right, the ending. Yeah, I'm not going to give away the ending either. However, what I will say is I found the ending totally believable. I think the ending has happened many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands of times in real life. Whether or not it's a satisfying ending to a lot of people, yes, there was a gasp by performance, and Michael, for all I know, we were at the same performance, but I know somebody else who was at a performance that I was not at who heard a gasp. Granted, he might have been at your performance, but still, that's at least two gasps, because 'cause nobody did see it coming. We really thought it was going to go in a completely different direction, which would have been fine too, by the way, and that would have made for a very satisfying play on its own level. But, you know, looking at it, if I were a playwright and I saw these two options, I think I would have gone with one that these guys did. So it's a tough one to really assess. Because of the odd production, the odd casting, the totally unbelievable plot twist, and yet, ooh, dead ending.
I think that I haven't seen the production of Straight, but what I have seen is the marketing.
They're really doing a good job with that.
Subway posters, they're getting it out there.
Shelters.
And really, really interesting push for a small production with seemingly a larger than normal off-Broadway budget. And it's running through May 8th, which is scheduled to run through May 8th, which is interesting to me because why would you run right up until that awards season and not continue through it? So
they're going to hope that they're going to get something. I think it has everything to do with that because the nominations will have come out by that point. Oh, of course, we're not talking about the Tonys.
Yeah.
It's only Broadway.
The Drama Desk.
The other, you know, Drama Desk, Out of Circle Critics, you know, I mean, Luatel Awards, all those things will be announced by May 8th. So under those circumstances, they may be hoping for a move to Broadway. But I guarantee you this, and I mean this, if this play moves to Broadway, I guarantee you that girl is going to be replaced.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move forward into Eclipsed. Peter got a chance to see Eclipsed at the John Golden Theater. So, Peter, what did you think about it?
Yeah, this is a tough play. Certainly, when the lights come up on this very, very distressed building, there are windows, but we don't see any glass. There are windows that weren't made to be windows. They were made to be walls. But unfortunately, the war in Nigeria, where this takes place, has made windows out of walls. Two women are there, and they have a girl played by the Oscar-winning actress from 12 Years a Slave, hidden under a tub, like a bathtub, upside down. And we have no idea why would they do that? Well, there's a damn good reason for it. And one, they're being very protective of her because these women are nothing but sex slaves. They want to keep that girl from being one. Good luck to that, I'm sorry to say. No, she's going to be dragged into the action, too. There was another girl, too, who was also involved, but she escaped. Now she's a militant, and she's certainly thinking of enacting her revenge, and she's trying to get the girl in the tub on her side. So it's a very, very powerful thing where you see these women inured to the fact that this is their lives, that when the men come to the – you don't see them, but you can tell when they're approaching from their reactions. They stand in a line and wait to see which one of the three of them will be selected. It's very powerful. there may be a little question on why one of the women is so good at reading English and how she got a biography of Bill Clinton. And the reaction, of course, to the Monica Lewinsky scandal doesn't strike them the way it strikes us because, of course, well, if guys in Nigeria can have four women, why can't the president of the United States have two? You know, so that's one of the questions asked. And but that's that makes the play sound frivolous, and I don't mean it to. It's very, very hard-hitting. It's going to be a tough sell on Broadway, frankly, because it's one of the more hard-hitting plays that we've had in a long, long time, and it does leave you with a real wrenched gut. So it's not the type of play you come out of singing. That's entertainment. So, but it is very impressive, and I do believe it's going to be a real player come awards time.
We're mounting up with a bunch of really strong plays in this season.
Sure.
Yes.
It's going to be another great one this year for plays. All right. So, Michael, you scheduled to see Eclipsed?
Yes, yes.
All right. And I am as well. So we'll come back and visit this and see if we agree with the Felicia or not. So, Michael Portantier, I am very, very jealous of you. Very, very, because this weekend, the Somewhere Project, where they did West Side Story, what, they have 700-800 people in the cast?
I think it was not far from that. There was a cast of you know, of professionals in the leads and the featured roles, but then in addition, they had hundreds of very young people, high school students, for singing chorus in, let's see, they did Somewhere, which was beautiful. They also came on at the about halfway through the quintet, which was unbelievable. They were standing all around, and it was life-changing, I'm telling you. And they were in a few other places. They worked in beautifully. It was this really unbelievable, amazing, breathtaking production by the Weill Music Institute of Carnegie Hall in a place called the Knockdown Center, way the hell out in Maspeth, Queens. And not even they wound up running buses from Carnegie Hall to help people to get there, because apparently if you did want to go by public transport, you'd get off at the last stop on the subway, and then you'd have to walk for 20 minutes through an industrial area to this former factory that is called the Knockdown Center and is now an event space, apparently. But and they have had performances there, but never anything like this. It was incredible. There is some video footage of a rehearsal, at least online, that you could find, and I urge you to look at it because it's hard for me to explain. The playing area was basically like a runway. I would say I'm bad at this, but it was maybe like 150 feet long, and then the audience was on either side of it, seated at tables right at the perimeter. Then in back of those audience members, there were risers on either side. And also on one of the far ends of the stage, there were tables and risers. And then at the opposite end was where the orchestra was, which I'm sorry I didn't count, but I think it was I think it was like a 40-piece orchestra or more. And it was conducted by Marin Alsop, who's a really great conductor and who was a protege of Leonard Bernstein. So how's that? It really was great. This was one of those productions, not the first I've seen, of West Side Story, where it was ethnically blind. It wasn't just that the Sharks were all Puerto Ricans, and then the Jets were all Anglo. Not by any means. There was a lot of mixing it up as far as that. So, which makes it kind of a different point. About the hatred in the show, because people can hate each other for any reason, not just for that. It worked beautifully here. There were a lot of the choreography was the Jerome Robbins, but then a lot of it was new, and it just the way that the classic choreography fit with the new was breathtaking in itself. The cast, the leads were Skylar Astin as Tony, Bianca Marroquin as Anita, Manny Stark was Riff, and introducing Morgan Hernandez as Maria. And I'm not sure exactly how old she is, but she looked every inch a teenager, and she had a wonderful fresh quality that even the best Marias I've seen could not, because you really can't fake that. I mean, you can try, but to actually have that youth and be that young as she was, it was extraordinary, and everyone involved, you know, should be just so proud of themselves. I hope that I imagine there must be, you know, video documentation of the whole thing. I certainly hope so, and I hope they do it again. You know, because next year is the 60th, right? 60th anniversary of mm-hmm. the Broadway mm-hmm. opening of West Side Story. So next year, not this year. So I don't know if maybe they have it in mind that perhaps they'll do this again. I think that would be amazing, and maybe do it for more of a run. The logistical issues of this were unbelievable. I know someone who knows someone who was in the orchestra, and they were very, very concerned about the acoustics because it's a factory. I think as I was walking by, I looked over, and I believe every instrument in the orchestra had a mic. And that's how they got around that. And then some genius mixed it in such a way that it sounded acoustically great. And the mix with the singers was perfect. And it was just an astounding achievement all around.
Wow. I'm reading here that the space is 50,000 square feet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So astounding. All right. Well, you've missed it. So we hope that it's been recorded somewhere. And as Peter says, you can't see them all.
No.
But do look for that video. I know that rehearsal video is there. And if only that, it'll give you kind of an impression of.
Yeah. I have the rehearsal video. I'll put it in the show notes. And also, I saw lots of really wonderful photographs on Instagram from this. So I'll see if I can collect those all.
Oh, and I should mention that seated ringside at the opening was Chita Rivera. And that in itself made it, you know, I mean, just brought the whole thing to another level. After the show, all the kids ran over and took photos with her. It was, I really started crying at one point, I'm telling you. It was unbelievable.
All right, let's move forward on to a new production called Boy, which was at Theater Row, and Peter got a chance to see that. So, Peter, tell us about that.
This is actually based on a real story. Once upon a time, a twin was taken in to be circumcised, and something went terribly wrong. And as a result, his penis was amputated in a terrible accident. So the doctors thought it was a good idea at the time to remove the testicles and raise the kid as a girl. Well, I remember reading about this in Newsweek after about the kid was 7 years old and saying, you know, it just goes to show nature versus nurture. I mean, you know, this kid's doing really well. This kid is happy as a girl. And see, if he had only known he was a boy, he'd probably be miserable, but he's really happy. And then years later, I read that wasn't true at all, that this kid always felt that something was wrong. I don't feel like a girl. I just don't. So this is the story that's being told. It has a better ending, well, a happier ending anyway, than the real story had. And Bobby Steggert, whom we admire so much and have since he made his debut in 110 in the Shade, is playing the boy. He also has to play the girl. Now, they don't dress him as a girl ever. It's just, you know, he's a boy when he is called or calls himself Adam. And you know that she's a girl when people refer to her as Samantha. So he's always in t-shirt and jeans, and that's that. So, there were a lot of questions here about whether or not the Doctor was doing this to aggrandize himself. Paul Niebank, excellent as the Doctor, whether or not he just wanted to make a name for himself in the medical world by proving a theory, and all. There are many, many visits that we see to his office that Samantha must make, and whenever Samantha indicates that something is wrong, the Doctor poo-poos it and indicates it's going to take time and all this kind of business, and we eventually come to realize that the Doctor may not be on the up-and-up, even if he means to be on the up-and-up, that it's just he's too self-centered to care about the ultimate effect on this boy. He does care about the kid. He does, but ultimately cares about himself more. So meanwhile, his parents, of course, have to go through this terrible ordeal, and it's really something to watch these parents have to deal with this kid day in, day out, who is surly. I mean, adolescence is tough for anybody, but I mean, for any parent especially, but good Lord, when you're facing something like this and you know what the reality was and what happened and the guilt you feel and all that, the playwright captures this very, very, very well. Tough play, 90 minutes, not as tough as Eclipse, I'll grant you, but it is a tough play, and it certainly is very well done, very well performed, very well written and directed. So if this is the type of thing that appeals to you, boy, is going to satisfy your needs.
Peter, that's so interesting. I could be wrong, but I don't believe the press materials said that he was a twin. So that's news to me. That puts a whole different spin on it, doesn't it? I mean, in addition to everything else.
Yeah, I'm starting to the twin is definitely there. Yeah. So you never see the other kid. But
you're saying it was a twin boy and girl, and then the boy had the accident during the circumcision and wound up being raised as a girl also?
No, they're both boys.
Oh, they're both boy
twins.
Oh, okay, and so the Samantha is the one that the boy is made into when he has the accident.
The boy has this terrible thing happen to him, and they raise him as Samantha for the longest time, though eventually he rebels and becomes Adam.
Right, okay. I just
the other kid we don't know anything about, really.
Oh, I see. I got you.
All right, that's a Keen Company production. So
Keen's good. Keen's good. Jonathan Silverstein really does a good job taking over from the original founder, Carl Forsman. They try to do plays that really are sympathetic to the human condition, and this one qualifies under those circumstances. They've really done very well by leaps and bounds, and I mean, they were in a much smaller space and a much less glamorous space than the Kloerman Theater at Theater Row. I'm not saying that these are show places that you walk into and say, oh my God, this is so architecturally significant, but they're clean, they're nice, you know, they're modern, they're comfortable, and there's something to be said for that. Well, the previous spaces weren't all those things at all.
And isn't it correct that they most often do revivals? So
yeah, this is rare for them. Yeah, that's the point, Michael. Good for you. Yeah, yeah. They don't do too many new plays or even ever. So so this is really quite a thing that they're trying now, and good luck to them.
Great.
All right, next up is another show called Walk Hard, which Michael and Peter got a chance to see. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Walk Hard?
Yeah, it's the Metropolitan Playhouse production of a Walk Hard by Abram Hill, set in 1939 and I guess written around that time. This is a playwright I will confess I knew nothing about, although I guess he's most famous as for his adaptation for an all-black cast of Anna Lucasta, which ran for over 950 performances on Broadway in 1944. And he had several other plays that he wrote. But I guess really, a very respected African-American playwright in at a time when there were few of them because they were given so few opportunities. And this play is interesting because it's about a young man who is actually, it's not really his idea. It's somebody else's idea who spots him and thinks he should become a boxer because he has the talent for it. And so he does. And it's interesting to me because I guess this in broad outlines, it sort of reminded me of the musical version of Golden Boy, which is the same basic story. Mm-hmm. Although in this case, the fellow does not really want to be an artist. So that's a different that's a different thing. But I thought it was really great that they found this play. I liked it. A lot of it very much. I thought it was overwritten. It's three acts performed in two. I thought that it made some of the same points over and over again, but it really was really interesting to see something from that time dealing with the racial issues and everything that this young man faces as he's trying to make headway as a boxer. So I really applaud them for doing it, and I just think it's so fascinating when these obscurities are brought back by these companies. I can't applaud them enough for doing that. And this is far better, than you would maybe expect from a play that is so old and that you've never heard of. So,
and ran seven performances on Broadway.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yes. So, yeah, really, really congratulations to them. Joshua David Scarlett is Andy Whitman, the central character. He was excellent, and some other really excellent performances. Chris Kraus, who was the fight choreographer, and he also had a small role. Sean Michael Buckley, Joy Suddeth Brook, and this wonderful guy named Beethoven Odin. How's that for an actor's name? So really, really applause to them, to the Metropolitan Playhouse, which is not that easy to get to. It's way over on East 4th Street, but worth the trip, I would say, definitely in this case.
All right, Peter, what did you think?
Yeah, we talked about it a while ago. I certainly felt the same, and was very impressed with the production. And you really have to think in time machine terms and what this play must have been like when it was first produced in 1946, because it really deals with civil rights. The word civil rights are used. And I can really understand why audiences on Broadway were very threatened by it. They didn't want to know about this. This was a play that was truly ahead of its time. And luckily, now it's not in its right time frame, because thank God we've progressed. But it is worth looking back and see where we were and where we needed to go.
It was so wonderful to hear the patois of the time, written by someone, who was writing when people actually spoke that way. Words like nerds, mm-hmm. And just really, really authentic in that way. I'm sorry, Peter, I didn't realize we had discussed it before.
Okay, so next up, Peter got a chance to see That Physics Show. Tell me about that show, Peter.
Well, there's a physics teacher up there with two assistants who's teaching us physics and telling us why things happen. Now, you have to understand that when I was attending Northeastern University, it was in a class of 526 kids. I finished in physics 525th above a kid from the Philippine Islands for whom English was a second language. So under those circumstances, this is not my type of thing at all. This gentleman who's doing it is speaking awfully fast and assumes that we know exactly what he's talking about because he knows what he's talking about. If you look at it that way, if you're going to learn anything about physics, you may have a tough time of it because he does take too much for granted. If you want to go and consider it a magic show, yeah, you could, because a lot of the things he does with fire and ice and a few other substances seem rather magical. And he explains to you why these things are happening in the way that they do. It's an 80-minute show, no intermission. The two assistants are rather engaging and do what they're told. And while this is not must-see theater at the Electra Theater, where, in case you don't know where that is, the entrance is on 43rd Street, right across from that Dollar Pizza place. And you go right near 8th Avenue, and it's on the second floor. And it's a decent enough space, very nice and wide. And I will advise you to try to go to a kiddie matinee, because I went to a kiddie matinee and it was just so great to see all these kids so enthusiastic. When they want people to come in from the audience, God, those hands were raised like crazy. Everybody wanted to be part of it. They didn't care what happened to them up there. I mean, some of them looked like they could even get hurt with some of these experiments, but no. The teacher knows exactly what he's doing, and there's no disaster at all. But you do get surprised from time to time, because you make assumptions, because he says to you, do you think this is going to turn out to be round or square? And it's clear that it's going to be square, except it turns out to be round. So it's that type of thing. So again, another one that's not must-see theater going, but if somehow your travels take you there, you'll probably have a decent enough 80 minutes.
That sounds fun. They're billing themselves as an alternative to Blue Man Group. And I think that – and the Gazillion Bubble show. So it sort of fits into that genre, if you like those shows.
Yeah, you know, what the award shows like to call unique theatrical experience. Yeah, it's one of those.
All right, the moment we've all been waiting for. Matt Tamanini's been waiting patiently to tell us about the Kinky Boots National Tour for the second time.
Well, I appreciate the wait, because I love listening to these guys talk about shows that I can't see. So I appreciate the information, even if it just means I sit here and don't talk for an hour. So.
Well, I think that the physics show would probably show up in Orlando somewhere.
Good. There's plenty of those types of things down here in Central Florida.
Well, you know, you get to sit down there for an hour, but we had to sit through Huey. So, Matt, tell us about the Kinky Boots National Tour that was at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts. Certainly was not a dollar. Expensive performing arts center.
It is. It's a gorgeous theater. But I went into Kinky Boots not with the highest of expectations. I obviously knew the great lineage that it had with Harvey Fierstein and Cyndi Lauper and all the Tonys that it won, and obviously knew at least a little bit about the really life-affirming, inclusive plot that it had. So I was excited about that, but all the different production numbers I'd seen and all of the, I don't know, glitzy, bedazzled costumes, it just felt a little flashy and a little more saccharine and bubblegum than the type of thing that I normally like. So I went in, admittedly, prejudging this show and expecting to kind of be maybe, you know, entertained, but not given a whole lot of substance to the show. And I left completely the other way coming out of it. I enjoyed it far more than I ever anticipated enjoying it. And I think that was really because I felt like the characters and the storylines, unlike what Peter had mentioned a little bit ago about knowing where a show was going, I felt like, even though I knew where the plot was going, I felt like they took the most circuitous route to get there with really unique characters and some really unique plot devices, and I really enjoyed it a lot more. You guys have all talked about this show, so I won't belabor the plot a whole lot, but I'll talk about some of the performers. Jay Harrison Gee is playing Lola. He's really, really fantastic, brings some really nuanced performance to it, and I didn't see Billy Porter, but I saw enough of it. He did plenty of TV and award show appearances, though I felt like I'd seen a little bit of his performance, and Jay Harrison Gee feels like a very different take on it, and I don't know if that's because he is a very tall, imposing man, so you put on those huge heels, and he just, I think his height and his stature just gives a very different feel to Lola than what I was used to seeing with Billy Porter, or even Wayne Brady when I've seen him do stuff in some videos and in TV appearances. But he was fantastic, very mesmerizing. Adam Kaplan plays Charlie. Again, you know, incredibly charismatic. I wasn't totally enthralled by his voice. He's it seems that his speaking voice is a little deeper, a little more baritone. And then when he sings, he's got all these high pop tenor notes, and it doesn't seem to mix. It seems very at odds. But to me, Tiffany Engen, who plays Lauren, really stole every scene, and I'm not sure if that's how it is in every production. Obviously, Anna Lee Ashford was a Tony nominee for the role, so obviously it's a well-beloved part, but she really stole almost every scene she was in, even if it was just standing next to a conveyor belt putting shoes in a box. So I came out of this far more entertained on every level than I expected going in, and I guess it kind of plays into the theme of the show that you can't judge something just by the way it looks or what you suppose it's going to be, and you have to kind of really get into it to understand what it's all about. So if you have the tour coming to your city, I would obviously recommend this one.
All right, and last week we went through the tour list, and I didn't open it up here, so let me get it. It is touring in, let's see, Fort Lauderdale, Fort Myers, Naples, Florida, Atlanta, Georgia, Kansas City, Missouri, Los Angeles, California, Seattle, Washington, San Francisco, California, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, New Haven, Washington, D.C., Madison, Wisconsin, Cleveland, Ohio, Durham, North Carolina, Edmonton, just, Alberta, Calgary.
Just say everywhere. Just say it's going to be everywhere.
So, as I mentioned, those are all dots that might be considered blue state leaning. The whole middle of America there. Wyoming, Idaho, Montana, North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Utah, Idaho, New Mexico, Texas. Don't seem to have Kinky Boots tour coming through there anytime soon. I wonder if that's a indictment of the climate.
Sure. This is the second year of the tour, so they've been on the road for a year already, so they very well could have hit some of those places already.
Oh, Matt Tamanini, you're so polypositive.
you don't read my political comments on Twitter, do you, James?
Oh boy, we're gonna have to have a whole show on that as the whole politics season rolls around here again. So,
as the king says in Once Upon a Mattress, I have a lot to say, but that's another story. Okay, go on.
All right, so I think that wraps it up for this evening. Before we get to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of Broadway Radio. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time there's a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. You can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, for Matt, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Owen, we'll have the video to that West Side Story, at least on the show notes as well. So last week, Michael had a trivia question. So why don't you give us the answer to that, Michael?
Yes, the question was, there are at least two musicals where some point before the shows opened, a song was cut from each, but then the music alone of that song wound up being used at the very beginning of the musicals. And the two that I was thinking of are Follies, which begins with the melody of a song that was written for the show that was called All Things Bright and Beautiful, and Chicago, which begins with that ba-da-ba-ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba, was a song called Loop the Loop, or Loop in the Loop. Mm-hmm. So those are the two I know. I would not be surprised if there were others. I don't believe that I heard from anyone else with any other suggestions.
Hmm. All right. Do we have a question for this week, Peter?
Yes, and it's not the one I was going to ask, but because Michael mentioned that when he saw Walk Hard that the author was responsible for Anna Lucasta, that it suddenly occurred to me there's a Broadway musical that mentions Anna Lucasta. Mm. Obviously, this will have to be a musical that came after 1944, because that's when Anna Lucasta opened and ran 2 years plus, which was really something for a black play at the time. And especially, boy, this is so relevant during this Oscar season, when Hollywood made the movie, they made it with white people. suddenly, Alexis Smith was playing Anna Lucasta.
Wow.
Now, that was 1949. However, yeah. 9 years later, in 1958, they finally did get around to making Anna Lucasta with Eartha Kitt and Sammy Davis Jr. So, and it's a good movie, by the way. So what musical? Famous? Well, all right. I don't know about famous, but you know, I'll narrow it down. No, I won't narrow it down. I'm not going to make it. No. What Broadway musical mentions Anna Lucasta? You're on your own.
All right. So if you have a clue there, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So,
you know, Peter, as per your comment, someone pointed out that especially with the opening of Eclipsed and with the reception that it's gotten, it looks like they're going to be a huge amount of people of color among the awards nominees. So we are not going to have anything remotely like the situation that we had at the Oscars.
No Tony's So White trending on Twitter?
I don't think so.
I also want to say that, you know, 6 months ago we were also saying we were not going to have Donald Trump as a Republican nominee.
Well,
you're really diving into the politics podcast, aren't you,
Jane? I'm sorry, it's Monday, I'm tired.
Anyway, I lost my thought because I'm so flummoxed by Donald Trump. I'm getting off. Bye, guys.
All right. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino and Matt Tamanini saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You fix your face and stand in place. Don't blink, don't shrink, and don't betray the thoughts you think, and never surrender. Guard what you own, and to save your tears for later when you're alone. And when the one you love begins to falter, when he's kicked so many times he cannot stand, when he medicates himself with too much liquor, starts to mumble, starts to yell at his crappy world of hell.